Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Amy Vickers. I describe her as a partner of Lloyd Pye. She can tell us a little bit later whether that is correct or what her professional relationship is. And she works with him where the Star Child skull is concerned. I'm sure that you will have heard of Lloyd Pye before, and you've possibly seen videos on the internet about the subject. Lloyd Pye has certainly been interviewed about it quite a few times. So let's hear a little bit more about it. So welcome to the program, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Now, what is your professional relationship to Lloyd Pye, who it's unfortunate that he couldn't be here in person, but I understand you're very conversant with the subject.
Yes, absolutely. Lloyd is actually doing a lecture tour through the UK and Europe at the moment, so unfortunately, while he would have loved to do the show, his schedule simply didn't permit it. But I've been working with Lloyd since 2004. He's the senior most member of the Star Child Project. I'm the second senior most member. And the Star Child Project is the research organization that has been studying the Star Child skull, a very unusual human-like skull that has some extremely non-human characteristics for about the last 13 years.
So tell us the background to the skull itself, because I understand it was found in Mexico around 1930. What do you know about that particular time of discovery?
Well, you're exactly right. It was found by an American tourist, a teenage girl actually, in the Copper Canyon region of Mexico sometime during the 1930s. Unfortunately, we have very little information from that time. She left a story. Unfortunately, she's passed on now, so we can't verify it. But the story that she left us with was that she was exploring some mine tunnels in the area and came across two complete skeletons, one human skeleton, it turned out to be a human female skeleton, and the second that she described as misshapen, a smaller misshapen skeleton, which was the Star Child skull. She attempted to recover all of the bones from both skeletons, but unfortunately most of the remains were lost in a flash flood that happened shortly thereafter, and the only bones that we have now is the human female skull, the normal skull, and the Star Child skull with a small piece of the upper maxilla, the upper jaw, from that skull. So we have, unfortunately, only those two skulls to work with, but the way the technology is advancing, we're able to determine so much about these beings just from those remains.
Is there any reason to think that the Star Child skull is in some way connected with the human remains that were found?
They're not genetically connected. We've done DNA testing on both skulls and were able to determine that the female skull was not the Star Child's mother or sister or any sort of genetic relation. However, the way that the girl that found them described them being buried, the Star Child skull was buried in a shallow grave with one arm sticking up out of the soil. The human skeleton was lying on top of the soil. So you've got the Star Child buried, the human lying on top of the soil, and that arm that's sticking up out of the soil is wrapped around the arm of the female lying on top of the soil. So it's almost as though she's taken the Star Child there, buried it, and then laid down next to it and died herself. So we think there may have been some sort of emotional connection. That's the only thing that made sense to us. If they had both died up there at the same time, they would both have been exposed. If they'd both been taken up there already deceased, they would both have been buried. So the most plausible scenario that we have is that she buried the Star Child, and then maybe she was sick, or maybe she was wounded, or maybe she committed suicide and she died next to it. We do have one interesting clue. There is a healed fracture on the skull of the human female, so it's possible that she had a very severe head injury and had some kind of mental illness from that, so maybe that played a role in it. But there certainly seems to have been a strong emotional connection on her part to make that effort.
Yes, and I would imagine in that particular time, whenever that was, that may be through superstition or fear, perhaps, as it was obvious, the star child wasn't a human, they might have actually been killed.
It's very possible. It's possible that, bearing in mind this was a different time we're talking about, they're both from 900 years ago. 900 years ago, people weren't enlightened about illnesses and deformities and things the way they are today. So it's very possible that there was a social stigma or even violence and aggression against the star child skull based on how it looked. The other possibility is that, in particular from that region, but really from all over the world, there are what's called the star being legends, which is the story of alien beings or divine beings coming down from the heavens and impregnating a woman non-sexually, just saying, you're going to have a baby now, and she gets pregnant and has the baby, and is told, you have to look after this child for a period of weeks or months or years, and after that, we're going to come back and collect it, and the whole village is responsible, and if anything happens to this child, there's going to be hell to pay. Well, if something did happen, if it had an illness or something else happened, it's possible that the woman took it away from the village and hid it in that mine tunnel as a way of trying to prevent any retribution against the village for its death. So there's a lot of possibilities and a very intriguing story.
So I believe from the tests you've carried out, you do not believe, or perhaps you have absolute proof, that the star child is not a hybrid human.
We don't believe that it's a hybrid human at this point, and that's based on some new genetic recoveries that we've done, some new DNA testing that have found DNA so different from human that it's really getting impossible to make any valid claim that even a hybrid human could survive with this kind of DNA. There's a particular kind of DNA we all have called mitochondrial DNA that's extremely similar across all of us. There's very little room for change or mutation in it. In fact, among all humans, there's only 120 variations that you can have without it being extremely harmful and most likely killing you. If you get up to, say, 130 variations, you just can't survive it. Well, in the star child skull, we're looking at about 900 variations. There's just absolutely no way a human could survive with anything remotely in that ballpark. So that's really pushed us toward thinking now that it must be a completely new species, a completely alien species. There's just no way that a human could survive with that DNA.
I feel the suggestion there must be that this star child must have arrived via some sort of craft, and possibly it may have even crashed and became sort of isolated on the Earth. Is that a possibility? I mean, I suppose this is all speculation now.
Unfortunately, it is all speculation, but that's certainly a valid prospect. There's nothing on the skull to indicate that it ever suffered any kind of trauma like a crash, but you would think any being capable of interplanetary travel would have a pretty good crash system. So that doesn't necessarily mean anything. There's really no way for us to tell whether it was born on Earth or born elsewhere. We do know from inorganic chemistry that we had done years ago and that we've recently redone just to double, triple validate the results, that for a period of months and even years, it was living on Earth and it was eating and drinking the same kind of foods that a human in that region would be consuming. So we know it was here for quite a period of time, but there's no way to know whether it was conceived on Earth or elsewhere. There is one very interesting point about the skull. It has extremely shallow eye sockets, and not just shallow, but unusually shaped in a way that you don't see with any kind of illness or deformity or anything that we currently know of, with one exception. Astronauts that have spent a long time in space, over a month in space in zero gravity, begin to get shallowing and reshaping of the eye sockets, very similar to what we see in the star child skull. Now, it's to a much lesser degree. It's very slight, whereas the star child is extreme, but it's the same kind of reshaping. So if 1 month in space starts making your eye sockets look like that, what would a year or 2 or 3 years in space do? So it could possibly indicate that the star child has spent some period of time in zero gravity to develop that unusual shape to its eye sockets. But it's also possible that that's just the way its genes tell it to grow and that it absolutely never left Earth. Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing at the moment, but it's certainly fertile ground for speculation.
Yes, I understand you've achieved a lot of information of that nature by examining the skull. I think you've spoken about a short neck, a very big brain, large inner ears. So even just on the basis of those few facts, it clearly isn't human by the sound of it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the early tests that we did was just a statistical comparison. We had a team that just took several points of reference on the star child skull, and then there are all kind of graphs and charts that they have in the study of human physiology, human skeletons. So it's very easy to do a comparison so you can see where you are in the curve of what's normal and what's not normal. And at every point in every analyzed aspect, it was off the charts. It was well outside the boundary of what a normal human variation can be. There's really not a single thing about this skull that is remotely the way that it can be or should be in a human.
I think we also discovered that the whatever this being was, certainly wasn't a child, and I think you found out that through some examination of the teeth. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a puzzling aspect of the skull. There are some elements of it that indicate that it was a child, and what I'm talking about is in the fragment of jaw that we have from the star child, there are both teeth erupted, and then there are teeth that are unerupted, still up in the bone waiting to come down, as you would have with a child where it's got its adult teeth up in the bone that haven't come through yet. However, the teeth that are already in the mouth, they don't look like children's teeth. They look like almost a cross between a child and an adult's tooth. But most importantly, they're worn down substantially. Even in a very grit-laden, rustic sort of a diet, you just couldn't get this kind of wear and tear in a child, especially not a child with very small chewing muscles, which is what the star child skull had. Its chewing muscles were only about a third the size of ours, and it had a very small mouth. So it just couldn't generate that much torque over a short period of time. It had to be, I would say, at the very least, late 20s and more likely early 30s, even if it was doing nothing but picking up handfuls of dirt and rocks and just chewing them all day long.
Yes.
So it's we really believe, based on that and also based on there's something in what's called the sutures of the bones. That's the section where the plates of the skull join. You can tell to a rough extent based on how those bone plates are joined together the age of the skull, and that also points to a being at the very least in its late 20s, a fully adult being, which is another fascinating aspect in itself, because now you have an adult being that seems to be capable of growing multiple sets of teeth, which is something that would be very handy and something that you would need if you had a very, very long life cycle. I mean, look at us. Most of us need dentures by the time we're 50 or 60. So if you're going to live to 160 or 260, you're going to need those multiple sets of teeth. So that's something that everyone has gotten very excited about. And our geneticist has hinted that there are some elements of the DNA that may indicate a very long lifespan as well. So we're very excited to see that as further testing develops.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting subject. Now, in these modern days, forensic build-ups seem to be very reliable and possibly accurate. Have you put it forward to have a forensic build-up to try and get some idea of what the real face looked like?
We've had a number of different forensic reconstructions done. We've had a couple of different sculptural reconstructions and a number of excellent graphic reconstructions, just drawings of the skull. In fact, recently on a channel, a History Channel program, I believe, called UFO Hunters. They did a forensic reconstruction. They hired a forensic artist named Bill Munns, who's excellent, who did a reconstruction of the Starchild skull, which looked very unusual. And we discussed it with him, and he said that part of the reason it looked so unusual was that he had a human template that he was working with, trying to put human muscles on it and trying to put human eyeballs in it. And in most cases, they don't quite fit. It's such a different template that he said it was a real challenge for him to try and make everything fit and work. But in every case, when we have these reconstructions done, you end up with a being that if they were walking down the street, you would pay attention. It looks very alien. It looks very unusual and very foreign. The shape of the skull is very odd. The ears are positioned very low down. The eyes are strange and bulging with unusual eyelids. And the lower face is incredibly narrow. It's almost like an upside-down triangle-shaped face. And really, far more than human, more than anything, it looks like a grey alien. It looks like the kind of alien that we're all familiar with, that they say was in the Roswell crash, the little grey man or the little green man with the big black teardrop-shaped eyes. And it sounds incredible, but it's amazing the number of forensic reconstructions we've had done and the number of them that have come up looking so much like those grey aliens. And really the only ones that have come up looking human are artistic interpretations rather than forensic reconstructions, where there's a lot more artistic license taken as opposed to the mathematical precision of a forensic reconstruction. So there are a bunch of them that your listeners are welcome to look at on starchildproject.com and decide for themselves, but it's definitely interesting that we are getting a fairly consistent look at this point.
Right. Now, you've mentioned the greys there. If I remember correctly, their eyes are almond shape. If that is correct, or even if they are simply very large eyes compared to ours, would they seem to fit the size of the eye sockets?
Yes, and I think that's part of why it consistently does look like a grey alien. Our eye sockets are basically shaped like a cone, where your eyeball goes into the large part of the cone, and the narrow part of the cone is a hole called your optic foramen, where all of the nerves and the blood vessels and all of the important things that are essential to your eye pass through to join your eye to your brain, basically. Well, in the case of the Starchild skull, instead of a cone shape, we have a little scoop, like a circular scoop, taken out of the bone. It doesn't have a brow ridge like we have. It doesn't have the bridge of a nose like we have. It's positioned differently on the face relative to the nose. And that hole that all of the nerves and the blood vessels go through is at the bottom of the eye socket instead of in the middle. We know from the indents of muscles in the eye socket that there was an eyeball in there. It did have the muscle attachments, and they are weighted. They do seem to have been actually used to move something. It's amazing that they can tell this just from indents in the bone, but our optical experts have told us that there is evidence that there was an eyeball in there, but that they can't conceive of how it could be a normal human eyeball. That if it was anything like ours, it would have bulged off the face, and there's no clear place within the eye socket that it would have fit. So it's entirely possible that it had a somewhat different shaped eye, and possibly even where our eye is a sphere, possibly even a flatter eyeball than we have, which would require a very large and a very unusual sort of an eyelid that would give you that almond shape as you see in the grey alien. So it's amazing that there really is the evidence to support that eye shape.
Yes, and I would imagine when you try and do a forensic build-up based on the human face, you do have this problem with face muscles, because it would seem to me from the various reports of the greys, how they look, one would guess that they don't in fact have many face muscles at all. They all seem to look exactly the same.
Yes, the Botox effect, they look expressionless. Well, unfortunately, when you're doing forensic reconstruction, it's hard to know what kind of expression they would have had. We do know that it does have those very small muscles compared to ours. And we also know, this is interesting, the roof of our mouths is very curved. There's plenty of room there for your tongue to move around and enable you to speak and form the different sounds. Well, the roof of the Star Child's mouth is very flat. It's like there's no room in it for a tongue whatsoever. So that impacts not only your ability to chew and eat, but also your ability to speak. So when you're looking at a being that has a very small lower face, very small muscles, and no real space for a tongue, it's almost like somehow its genes had decided it didn't need that or wasn't going to use that very much, and so it didn't invest much effort in building up big muscles and lots of space to accommodate things the way that ours are. So that opens up a whole other realm of possibilities, ranging from how did it communicate, was it telepathy, to, as you say, did it really use expressions, or was it just a very blank sort of a face that didn't need those muscles or didn't use those muscles?
Yeah, and I think there was another, just jumping back to the Star Child for a minute, I think there was another very strong factor there that told you it wasn't human. That was because of the thickness of the bone.
Yes, absolutely. The bone of the Star Child skull is between a third and half as thick as human bone, so very much thinner than human bone and correspondingly lighter, much thinner, much lighter than human bone. And yet it's so much stronger than human bone that when our geneticist went to cut a sample using a human bone saw, an electric bone saw, something that cuts through our bones like butter, that blade literally bounced off the Star Child skull, and in the end they switched to a diamond-coated blade to get a clean cut. So, I mean, this is so much stronger than our bone. Biochemically, it's a lot more like tooth enamel than normal bone. But more than that, there are fibers inside this bone. Now, we don't have this. Nothing else on planet Earth has this. But inside the bone of the Star Child skull, there are reinforcing fibers. We don't know what they are yet. Unfortunately, we do have evidence of them. You can see them under a scanning electron microscope, a very powerful microscope. But unfortunately, the microscope is so powerful, it actually vaporizes the sample as you're looking at it. So unfortunately, that makes things a little bit tricky. But because nothing like this has been seen before, there isn't actually a protocol invented to remove these fibers from the bone yet. We don't have a test that we can do. So we basically have to invent the way to get these fibers out and invent the way to test them so we know what we have. So that's kind of been prohibitively expensive and impossible for us to really move forward on at this point. But I mean, you can't get more alien than fibers growing through the bone. That just doesn't happen in anything on this planet. And for anyone that's wondering, we have had bacterial and fungal experts look at these fibers, and they assure us that they aren't any kind of contamination, that they are indeed native to the bone. So I mean, we're really looking at something as alien as you can get, as different as you can get. There's just no way to say that this is some kind of human deformity. It's very exciting stuff.
Yes. The thoughts also occurred to me, again, thinking about the Greys, that they have apparently been trying to create human hybrids, and it would seem that when they have contacted likely mothers to be on the Earth, they have been impregnated in some way to give birth to the hybrids. And as you said, at a certain stage, they sometimes have removed them from the womb, or I guess taken them over at birth. So it's possible, isn't it, looking back, although you don't think there was any relationship between the Star Child and maybe the woman whose bones were found there, there could have been something strange going on, I suppose.
Yes, it is possible to have absolutely no genetic relation to a child that you carried a full term. This is actually an area of study that I'm particularly interested in. There are so many cases, not only anecdotal cases, but also very compelling physical evidence of women who are impregnated they claim by aliens, by angels, by something from the heavens, and then they do tend to have that fetus removed, often very early in the pregnancy, often even in the first and second trimesters. They just wake up one morning and they have every sign of a miscarriage, but no fetus. And it seems to be that in times past, these beings would permit women to carry the children to term and bond with them over a period of time. The stories that we have, and your listeners are free to take them or leave them, because unfortunately they are just anecdotal, but I think they're still very interesting. The stories that we have are that the grey aliens are not at all empathetic. They don't seem to have emotions the way that we have. And so where there are hybrid children, they basically suffer from what's called failure to thrive syndrome. They're just unhappy with these robotic, unfeeling beings, and they don't do very well. And so one of the women that actually did one of the forensic reconstructions of the Star Child, she didn't actually do one of the Star Child, but she's an artist who's done various other alien drawings, a woman named Josie Galanti, whose work you can see on starchildproject.com. She claims to have been impregnated like this, and then a few years later to have been taken on board an alien ship and told, "This is your son. He's not doing well. Bond with him for a little while." And she did, and she said she was absolutely positive it was her child, but that he was very pale and unhealthy and clearly failing to thrive. So it seems that the way that they used to do it, where they would let the mothers raise them to a period of a certain age, seems to have been much more successful for them than what they are apparently or allegedly doing now, where they're now having to look at bringing mothers back on board to try and bond with these poor children that are so hopelessly, unemotionally connected to these robotic grey alien beings.
Yes, I can remember reading some while back that where someone had contact with the greys, they did try to explain that in their normal way, in fact, they do lack emotions, and they wanted to understand them and have them introduced into their race. So they are producing these human hybrids partly with that in mind. So that's interesting. Now, is there any other precedent throughout the world, any other skull or remains that could be remotely connected with the Star Child skull?
Not necessarily connected with the Star Child skull. There are other remains that we believe to be alien. Zachariah Sitchin, a very well-known author in the field of alien intervention, he wrote a number of books, The Twelfth Planet and various others, and is a well-known character, identified a specific set of remains named Lady Puabi, or Queen Shudab, is another name for the same remains, which are currently in the British Museum of Natural History. And the Sitchin family and various other organizations and Lloyd Pye have been working with that museum, attempting to get those remains tested, because Sitchin was absolutely convinced that she was an Anunnaki, that she was an alien princess. There was also in Peru literally hundreds of skulls that I firmly believe are alien. There are some that are human skulls that have been reshaped to look a little bit odd. And then there are other skulls that are radically different. The bone is much thicker than our bone. The brain is twice the size of our brain. The eye sockets are much larger. The jaws are much heavier. They just have characteristics that there's no way that you can turn a human skull into that. So those are called the conehead skulls. They are in Peru, and they're very well documented. And I think that they, and possibly also Lady Puabi, are right up there with the Star Child in terms of being provably alien. And I think that all of those are going to come to light. Whichever of them comes first, whichever is tested first, and whichever opens the floodgates, I think it's going to be quickly followed by the other two.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's true to say that most of the ancient histories do talk of meetings with gods from the skies, or whatever they like to call them. And it would seem quite apparent that our civilization in the past, thousands of years ago, has in fact had a lot to do with these sort of space beings. Have you looked at that sort of history yourself? I mean, what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I'm particularly intrigued by the number of different religious texts that have very strong similarities in their creation stories. If you look at the ancient Sumerian text, which is what Zechariah Sitchin and Lloyd Pye and various others have dealt with, they go so far as to use wording like these gods, they talk about gods as a plural, basically aliens, creating the Adamu, as in Adam, in the house of fashioning and then putting him in the Eden, as in the Garden of Eden. Now, these are thousands of years before Christ. These are well before the Old Testament, and yet you have that same story coming through and being used in the Christian religious texts and in various other religious texts around the world. It's an incredible similarity. And in every case, when you go back to the early texts, they're talking about multiple plural gods. They're talking about gods that interacted with humans, that had children with humans. It's really quite shocking what we think of as being in the Bible and what's actually there. And that's just one example that's very well known to us being Western. But it is the same kind of stories that you get all over the world. Every culture that there is talks about beings coming down from the sky. Now, why not beings coming up from the earth or coming up from the water if they're just going to make things up? The reason we all have the same stories is because it's the truth. It's what really happened. It's a history. It's not a mythology. And I think that the further we delve into intervention theory and alien reality, the more apparent that's going to be. That there are, in every religious text, in every mythology, they describe multiple gods, multiple entities coming down from the heavens. Now, if they were going to make it up, if it is just a mythology, if it is just something that an ignorant person sat around a fire one day and said, oh, I'll make up a story, why are they all coming from the heavens? Why are they all describing similar things? Why are they all describing bright lights and this and that and the other? Why not coming up through the earth or through the water? I think the fact that we have the same story across so many cultures, across such huge distances and across such a vast amount of time has to indicate that this is the truth. It's not a mythology. It's an actual history. And I think that is very compelling. I think that as we move forward with disclosure, with accepting aliens as a reality and exploring intervention theory, the idea that aliens have been interfering with humans from the very beginning, I think that that is going to become a much more serious line of study for people, not just we on the fringe, but a much more mainstream topic.
Yes, I agree with you there. And when you look at the history of the evolution of man, they always talk about the missing link. But if you allow for the genetic changes that have been made in the human, maybe you have the answer there.
Well, yes, my colleague Lloyd Pye has done a lot of work and research in this field, and I find it very compelling and absolutely fascinating. But there does absolutely seem to not be a missing link, but a missing step, the point where we suddenly go from being a pre-human, depending on whose research you read, a Cro-Magnon or a Neanderthal or whatever else, to suddenly being modern humans. And there is no missing link because there isn't some link between the two of us. There's a step in a laboratory that you just aren't going to find the evidence of more than we already have. And we have that evidence. It's right there in our DNA. You can see it very clearly that there are parts of our DNA you can look at and you can see, oh, well, this has been spliced and this has been changed. And anyone that understands genetics can look at these things and see them very clearly. And there's always the mainstream explanation that anything's possible and you can have this and you can have that. But really, that's just whitewash that most people can see through, and I think is going to go the way of the dodo. I think there It's no different than any other major step in history. There's always people that are just so against it that they refuse to look at the evidence that's really there and just get blinded by the conclusion that they want to see. And I think as soon as we get past that enforced blindness, everyone's going to say, oh yes, of course, I can see that. Everyone can see that. Of course we were genetically engineered.
Yeah, yes, indeed. I agree with you. It's a bit unfortunate that the many sciences that the establishment has a very rigid set of beliefs, and they don't really like someone coming in and upsetting.
Are you with me, Amy?
Yes, I'm with you, Mike. Michael, okay, I can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, I've changed over to the landline now because of the problem on the Skype. I was going to mention to you about a program I saw which was illustrated where they were showing the human fetus at a very early stage along with a reptile's fetus, and it seemed to indicate that the human fetus actually at that stage has a tail. So maybe the inference there is that various types of extraterrestrials have had some input in our sort of genetics. Have you ever heard of that or seen it?
Yes, I've seen exactly what you're talking about, and it's one of those things that's very interesting but doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot, because if you look at most beings on this planet in their early stages of development, pretty much everything has that tail. And that's one of the arguments that evolutionists use to say we've all evolved up from dinosaurs, lizards, what have you, reptiles, which is one of the reasons why they say reptiles are one of the earliest things, and various other tie-ins that they have. I don't necessarily think it means that we have evolved from reptiles or that any reptile type of alien species has necessarily had any input in creating us. That said, the aliens that we do believe created us based on the ancient texts that we have, the Sumerian tablets and various other things, those aliens are known by several names. The most common is the Anunnaki. And they basically look very similar to us. They look very much like modern humans, but they're much smarter and live hundreds and hundreds of years and capable of things we aren't capable of. But who's to say that somehow in their genetic makeup there isn't a reptilian influence, and so when they made us, that came through. It's really hard to know. You start to get back to first cause and original beings then, and that's where it gets very murky, because it's just so much speculation. But it's certainly an interesting point that you bring up.
I'm just talking about reptilians. To my mind, they certainly have visited the Earth at various times, along with the more human-looking space people. And I noticed amongst some of the old artifacts, like the little statuettes and things like that, that come from areas like Colombia, Peru, where they seem to have been visited thousands of years ago, you can positively see that some of these little statuettes are depicting reptilians, because obviously their features are very distinctive. So I think when people are serious in their endeavours to research these types of subjects to see what evidence there is for space beings visiting us, I think there's a lot of it there also in the ancient text. And you've mentioned Zacharias Pitkin, and he did a fantastic lot of work in decoding the tablets in Sumeria, and a lot of it is really to do with the Anunnaki visiting the Sumerians. By the sound of it, you've also read a lot of that information. I mean, what do you feel about these different sort of space beings visiting us in the past?
Well, I'm very much a proponent of Lloyd Pye's work, who built on the work that Zechariah Sitchin did. It's just amazing the body of evidence that there is out there. I certainly agree with you that I think there are multiple different types of aliens. I think it's silly to try and say there's only one sort of alien species. And I think that all of them have visited us at some point, and most of them just can't be bothered with us because we're so stupid and undeveloped compared to them. And I think those that have, I really don't think there's any threat or any danger from any of them, because we're all still here and we're all still living our lives. But the beings that are described in those Sumerian tablets are always these very human-like beings, and they're very clear and very explicit that they came and they gave us this technology and that technology, and they could fly and they lived hundreds of years, and they bred with humans, and that they created us, and here's how they did it, and they go into detail in a way that we don't normally see. Normally, when we are looking at an ancient text, as lay people, we're getting a cleaned up, sanitized version that has been translated and then interpreted and reinterpreted and polished and made into something that fits in with what we already believe and what we already think. It's very unusual that you have someone like Sitchin that goes back to the original text and learns how to speak this incredibly complicated ancient language so that he can understand what is being said in the first place. And on his reading of it, of reading the actual original text instead of the sanitized versions, it's amazing the information that he came out with, things that are can be interpreted very clearly as being a UFO and very clearly as being an alien and very clearly as saying, here's where we come from in your world, here's what your solar system looks like, things that these people couldn't possibly have known. And it's almost like they were leaving breadcrumbs for us to show us that this is information that they couldn't possibly have known for themselves, that they are getting it from some higher outside being. And they say very clearly, they made us and they interfered with our DNA and they did this and they did that. And we're a slave species for them. And so they made us less strong and less smart than they are, which is pretty much exactly what we are. And there's so much evidence for that. You know, our muscles are pound for pound 10 times weaker than a primate, the thing we supposedly evolved from. Our brains are so much more complicated than we understand even today. I'm sure you've all heard of savants, those people who have generally really severe mental handicaps, can't even tie their own shoes, and yet they're a musical genius or a mathematical genius. It's like somehow the thing that has stopped them using most of their brains that we use has let them access something in their brain that's there, that we all have, but that we're cut off from. So it's very much like we've just been denied access to abilities that we seem to have within our own bodies. And that's exactly what you would do if you were building a slave species. And more to the point, exactly what is said in these ancient writings. So, I mean, it's just a huge body of evidence and way more than we can fit into your brilliant show, but it's definitely worth looking at. And I should mention that my colleague, Lloyd Pye, is a very strong scholar of this field and has put out some brilliant videos and other things on YouTube, freebies on the website lloydpye.com, that's well worth taking a look at.
I noticed when you were talking of some of the ancient texts that I was reading about a person who's looking at some of the biblical stories, and he said that often where the Hebrew word is interpreted as God, he said, in fact, it's not talking of a God, they refer to gods. And when you start thinking of some of the information in the Bible in terms of gods, I think you begin to realize they're talking about many higher beings visiting the earth.
You're absolutely right, and that I know the exact story that you're talking about, and it's pinging all over the place at the moment because it is so interesting. But the truth of it is, I used to be a Sunday school teacher, so I have read the Bible cover to cover many more times than I wish I had, and it's amazing that in some parts of the Old Testament, even in these sanitized, cleaned up versions, they still slip up every once in a while and they still talk about gods as a plural. So, I mean, the information is there. It's amazingly there. It's just not something that people usually would look at or pay attention to. Or even if they did, they'd just think it was a typing error or something like that. They wouldn't realize that it's there because that's what it says in the original text. So, I mean, I think that's fantastic that this is becoming more widely known.
Indeed, yes. And in the Old Testament, you also find exactly the same names like Enki and Enlil, who were the gods that visited the Sumerians. So, in actual fact, some of the biblical stories actually confirm the ones that Zechariah refers to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's important to remember that those Sumerian texts came before the Bible. So it's really the Bible that's copying off, as we said, word for word, things like the Adamu being Adam and Eve and the Eden being the Garden of Eden, things like that. It is amazing. And there is synchronicity like that in religious texts all over the world. It's fantastic when you start delving into this.
Indeed. Now, I'm not sure about the facts behind this, but I bet you'll know, that they found some very strange elongated skulls in Peru near the Naxa lines. I don't know whether they were inferring that they could be similar to the Star Childs, but they were apparently very elongated. Would you know about those?
Yes, those are called the conehead skulls, and those are among those that I mentioned earlier that I think are also going to prove to be alien. In Peru, there are hundreds and hundreds of very unusual elongated skulls. Now, a lot of them are normal human skulls that have just been reshaped as babies to make them look like these other skulls, that there's just no way to make a human skull look that way. The bone is much thicker, the brain is twice as big, the eye sockets are different. You just can't make that kind of change to a baby's skull. It doesn't work that way. And I believe, and I'm certainly not alone in this, that these will also prove to be probably a different kind of alien. And it's very interesting when you start looking at some of the Egyptian texts and things and the Egyptian headdresses, that the shape of these skulls is very similar to the shape of the head that gods in various cultures are considered to have had, gods being beings from the heaven, being aliens. So these skulls are there, are prolific, and actually, believe it or not, our genetics team, the same lab that is working on the Star Child skull, is also involved with doing genetic testing on samples that have been obtained from a museum in Peru of some of these skulls. So that's not progressing hugely fast at the moment, but is moving forward and should give us some very interesting results.
That's interesting as well, yeah. So, what is the main theme of Lloyd's lectures that he gives about this? I mean, is he actually trying to prove that the skull is from a space being? Or, you know, what's his sort of line that he talks about?
Well, Lloyd Pye and myself are both part of a scientific team. We're working very hard to try and get definitive proof one way or the other about what the Star Child skull is. The results that we have at the moment are extremely compelling, but they are preliminary results. But nonetheless, we can't really say anything that the science doesn't back up. And right now, the science has shown us a being that has DNA that's so different from ours that a human couldn't survive it. that's so different from ours or any other kind of pre-human that there's really no way to say that it's any sort of human species. It's just off the charts in every single way. So we're looking at either a radically new and radically different species living with humans 900 years ago, which is going to completely rewrite the history books, or we're looking at an alien being which has come here from somewhere else, either has been conceived here from genetic material that's not from here or has been brought here later in life. So that would also obviously rewrite the history books. So as Lloyd does his lectures, I'm sure that he's putting out the same information that everyone else on the team is, which is here's where we are now with the research, here's where we hope to go with it. And it looks, for all intents and purposes, like we have an alien. But until we have the full genome, which is likely to take another couple of years, we won't be able to know for sure. But I believe he's also discussing in some detail his work with alien intervention and intervention theory, which is the idea, exactly what we've been talking about, that aliens have been here many times before, that they've been heavily involved in human development over time. And he does some really fascinating work on that, which I think, frankly, is more interesting to some people than the Starchild skull. But the main difference is the Starchild skull is a real and a tangible thing with verifiable, repeatable DNA. So it's going to stand up to skepticism and criticism in a way that nothing else has ever really been able to. And we think it's going to be the thing that starts disclosure, that starts a really genuine discussion about aliens in our world. And we think it's going to happen in the next couple of years.
Yes, indeed. I mean, does Lloyd try and press the American government for information about bodies retrieved from UFO crashes? Because one has to think that with their interest in these space beings, they must have a lot of information themselves.
I'm sure that they do. That's not a field that we're actively involved with. I know there are a lot of people out there that are pushing for that kind of disclosure, and we certainly wish them all the best. But you kind of have to choose your battles in this field, and we're pretty much consumed with the research that we're doing on the Starchild skull. We think the best thing that we can do for that kind of disclosure is prove that this skull is real and take away some of that stigma and some of that fear that is keeping that information hidden. I do believe that there have been crashes, at the very least that the Roswell crash was real, and I think that that information will be released over time. But there have been so many people that have said, no, it's not real, that are going to get some serious egg on their faces, that I think it's going to have to be a gradual process where everyone can save face and somehow it's all going to work out roses for all of the people with power, because that's how it always does. The answer is no, we're not.
It's been a very interesting program, and I've enjoyed speaking with you. It's a very special subject, I think, and not too many people have the sort of knowledge about it that you and Lloyd do. Now, just very quickly before I have to say goodbye to you, would you like to give any other detail of Lloyd's website or something like that where people can contact him through it or his videos and whatever?
Yes, I would love to encourage everybody to visit starchildproject.com, starchildproject.com. And if you happen to be in the UK or Europe, definitely do visit and have a look at our upcoming events page, because Lloyd is doing venues all over the place through the next month. So that's I'm not just saying this because I work with him. He really gives a fantastic presentation, and it's well worth it, even if you have to make an effort to get there. But there is tons of information on the website and on YouTube if you can't make it. Really, though, don't start it late at night when you're tired, because you won't be able to put it down. It's amazing once you delve into it. Starchildproject.com.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that, Amy. Thank you very much for coming onto the program. I'm sure my listeners have thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, friends, next week I've got Susan And Scott Ramsey coming along, funnily enough, something else to do with aliens. It's to do with the Aztec incident where they found a 100-foot disc, and looking inside, the people who found it saw two small childlike beings, about 3 to 4 foot in height, who appeared to be dead. So please join me next week. It sounds like another interesting program coming up. Thank you for being with me. God bless you all. Thank you.